typically do, we start with the approval of the minutes. So have we looked at the minutes enough to feel like we can approve them? Jackie's nodding and Heidi is.
I move that Linda we approve question. The minutes from September 24th, 2020 as submitted.
I have one correction in the, I'm not looking at them right now, but Mary Farrell's name was Mary Farrow instead of Farrell from Massa.
Well, it's been moved and seconded, all in favor of accepting the minutes as slightly amended, say aye.
Aye.
Okay.
So I wasn't looking, who's the second? Who seconded the?
Jackie.
No, I think it was somebody else. I'm happy to.
I'll second it.
Okay, Chris did. Thank you.
Thank you.
And so in terms of public forum, we didn't have anybody sign up?
No, we do have two attendees who are just here to, you know, watch. They did not. So, you know, the new public forum policy is that you should email me by 10 o'clock the morning of the meeting if you want to speak during the meeting. And no one emailed me. But we do have two people who are watching the meeting and listening. Oh my gosh, I can't say her name.
Aliana Darrell.
Thank you.
The tidings reporter.
Yes.
Okay.
And, Daniel Cesares are two.
I know Daniel. Okay. I'm going to mute myself when we go into the next one. Apparently, my gas meter thing is beeping. The battery is down. And so I'm going to go on mute while I turn this part of it over to Linda.
Okay. So Rich asked that I just give a brief update on the Affordable Housing Trust Fund and CDBG award process that took place at the council. And I don't know if any of you watched, but NeighborWorks Umpqua did present at the meeting, and so did Maslow Project, and of course, Options for Helping Residents of Ashland. The council was very appreciative of the work that all of those groups are doing and have done, and obviously, specifically, the groups that are doing work related to COVID right now. But they were very complimentary of NeighborWorks Umpqua, and a lot like the commission is very interested in those long-term housing solutions, and so was very supportive of their application. So all of the applicants were awarded the amounts that they asked for I'm totally blanking on the word, consistent with your recommendation, except for Maslow Project. So, you know, I think Steph Steffinger specifically asked whether any of the programs were targeting families with children. And Maslow's Project obviously does, because that's the population they work with. And they mentioned that because of the people displaced by the wildfire, some of those children who were in talent schools, Phoenix talent schools, have transferred to Ashland schools. And so they were seeing an increase in families who were attending Ashland schools, but were really, you know, residents of Phoenix or talent. And so they were trying to find housing for those families as well. And one of the things that she mentioned, which I think was part of the reason why Councillor Steffinger recommended and adding funding to their request, was that, you know, these families, as they come in, are needing to have a place where children can do school online. And so Mary mentioned that they have more students and families than they had really funding to address the sort of long-term hotel stays that they were essentially providing for families. And so it was really a matter of how long can they keep these people in this living situation to kind of provide that continuity and stability to the students. So everyone was very in favor of supporting that work, though there was a little contention about, you know, giving them additional money at this time. So there was some conversation about that. But in the end, they agreed to give them an additional $30,000. So that was, and they also agreed to the flexibility. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Linda.
Oh, so is that trust fund money? What is it, where does that $30,000 come from?
So I'm glad you asked that because that was what I was going to talk about. So they were understanding of the flexibility that the city staff was requesting in order to, you know, play a shell game with all this federal and general fund money to try to leverage as much as we could. And the sort of the breakdown that came out is that both Maslow Project's activity and the non-congregate sheltering portion of ORA's application, which was a total of $48,500, both of those are coming out of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. So Maslow Project's, all of theirs is non-congregate housing, and that is something that we can be reimbursed for through FEMA, should FEMA approve that, you know, because you have to constantly reapply monthly to get that funding from them. And so does that portion of ORA's application. However, the congregate sheltering portion and the navigation services and any meal services provided by ORA would not be covered by FEMA. They are not reimbursable. And so that portion of their request was $125,483. So that money will be coming out of the CDBG fund. And it's split into two separate contracts, obviously, because they're two separate sources of funding. And so, I'm going to run these two things together if it doesn't isn't bothersome to you two or to you to this group. The awards that were made are obviously addressing, you know, the sum total of all the funding that we have right now, which is separated into pots, and you can see that from the attachment to the memo. And for those of you who did watch the council meeting on Monday, this is essentially the same presentation I gave to the council, though I did have a request in advance to talk more about where the funding comes from and who's been benefiting. But I don't think I have to do that for you guys because I feel like you have a good handle on it because we've been talking about it. But you'll see from the funding breakdown that was provided in the packet that the 2019 money that we received way back when, the 178,562, we did award Maslow and St. Vincent de Paul and Food Angels that funding. But I did something tricky. Once we found out that we could waive the public service limitation on that funding, there was still some money that from Food Angels that we hadn't paid out. So I switched the remaining balance of that grant to an earlier grant because their money was capital and I could spend it there so that we could have a little bit more money. I mean, I'm talking like $5,000 more money, but I thought we might just as well because, you know, $5,000 pays for you know, like 6 weeks worth of meals. So I shifted some of that money. So in the funds committed, when I show that full $18,000 that we awarded to them, I did not take it out of that $78,000. So there's a little number confusion that probably might be confusing to people. So then we also have the 2020 allocation, which you'll remember because it happened more recently, which was the 176,925. And out of that, we had awarded Maslow Project and ORA public service funding to address rental assistance that, you know, St. Vincent de Paul had been doing, but also Maslow Project to continue their case management. And I did another funny thing. We also awarded Food Angels. So I took their allocation again, and I put it to an earlier, some earlier funding that we had that was only allowed for capital. So I did that shifting again so we could have more of that money available for public service activities. And then we actually had increased when the COVID rent moratorium happened And there was a big push at the state level to make sure we had enough rental assistance money. The city administrator and city staff approved an increase in that original allocation that we gave to Aura, because our original allocation was based on that 15%, like that cap that we could only provide. You know, I think they had asked for $25,000, but we had split the allocation evenly between them and Maslow, giving them both $13,000. So we actually gave Aura $50,000 in rental assistance. And, you know, I don't know for some of you, if you know or not, but Aura also received about $800,000 in rental assistance money from the state. But that money did not come with hardly any admin overhead. So they had to hire, and that money has a shorter time period for expenditure. So they have to spend all that rental assistance money by the end of December. And they needed to hire more case managers to address the, you know, the increased need. Plus it was it's a kind of a long process that they need to go through to work with these people. And so what we ended up doing is that $50,000 we gave them is not being used for rental assistance. It's being used for administrative costs to administer the $800,000 that they got, all of which is allowed. And so that allowed them to hire more people and get that money out the door faster and meet those needs. And then all along, obviously there's the hotel and meal delivery piece that we had talked about way earlier on. So that was $103,808 that we gave to Aura. But then we also had been paying Peace House, and we're still paying Peace House to do meals. So we started out in the beginning just doing like 6-week contracts, just to say, you know, hopefully in 6 weeks, things will be different and we can go back to what we were doing before. And then when it didn't happen, we said, okay, well, let's extend it again. So the first couple of extensions were $20,000. And then then we had to do a new contract at that point for $32,000. So that's, we can see that in the spreadsheet that we spent that. And then also we had done a little creative funding with the Aura shower trailer, and then to keep it running, we dedicated another, you know, just under $20,000 for that, and then the $125,483 for the winter shelter program. So altogether, I mean, you can see and I meant to mention, you know, we got the CDBG CD allocation in March. And that was the $104,079, which was just amazing. And we did not expect to get more money. We knew there was an additional funding allocation, but the way it was worded was that the Secretary of HUD could decide which communities had the most need and allocate the funding according to that need. But they didn't do it that way. They just did the straight formula allocation. So we ended up getting an additional allocation in September of $189,741. So more money, which is great. We don't actually have that money in our account yet, but we should soon. The earlier things that we talked about this before, we had to amend the 2019 consolidated plan, or not consolidated plan, action plan, and submit that to HUD. And HUD allows for only a 5-day public comment period. That was part of the waiver. So I have to amend it again, or I have amended it again. It is on the city's website right now with the amendment that we are planning to use $125,000 to support Aura's winter shelter efforts right now. And so on Tuesday, that should be done, and I can send that to HUD, and hopefully we can get our grant contract and they'll release our money. So that's all the CDBG stuff. We have a balance of about Okay, go ahead, Heidi.
What happens if Aura can't spend that 800 and some thousand dollars? That's a huge amount. And they have to spend it by this December?
Yes. No problem. We just had a board meeting and it's almost all gone.
Yeah.
So believe me, it's not a problem.
Find the housing and
For housing and rent, yes, and rent reduction, temporary housing, yes.
Wow.
No problem. So we have over 70 people coming in a day. We have 6 navigators now. We have a bilingual navigator in Spanish. We're just busting out of the seams with people and services, but it's not a problem getting that money. And it's a big problem for other organizations when you have to do the HUD data collection. Mm-hmm. And Linda knows this very well, how much time it takes to work. It's a 22-page application on a lot of this stuff to get them. So very, very time consuming, but no problem getting the money to the people who need it.
Well, I think at some point we should have Aura come, you know, when things slow down, maybe at the end of the winter shelter season, and talk about all these things, because I think this is amazing work. And I don't know that community members, you know that this is going on, though certainly there's been a big push to get that information out there so that people can go. But early on, I mean, Access has more money than that. I mean, they got the lion's share, and they had, like, instantly out of the gate, they were backed up by 2 weeks. Like, you had to call, and then they were going to call you and then make an appointment for 2 weeks later. But Oru was able to hit the ground running, staff up, and I mean, you guys have been just churning people out. And I don't know, there's a couple other people who got the grants, but I think Aura had to take over one of the grants, the UNITE one, and then Family Nurturing Center has the other one. So I don't know how well they are doing, just keeping up. I mean, there's a lot of need and a lot of demand, but certainly it's the process takes a while. And like you said, having that HMIS system already on board and knowing how to use it is really amazing and important.
Let me see what other questions we might have. If anybody's got all that down in their mind, amazing, because that's a lot of information to take in at once. I just categorize it as basically we are being flexible with how we're responding to a very deep and complicated issue. And we're really relying a lot on staff to maintain the best flexibility that we can. And as we go through the winter, we're going to be able to see we are able to get services, but also hopefully we're going to end up with still some resources in the Housing Trust Fund that we can move forward in the future with. So
we do have balances in both the CDBG fund and the Housing Trust Fund. We have about $113,000 in public service money, and I am splitting those things out just so we know what we can do and what we can't do. And then we still also have $153,000 in capital money. So that's that back to that same, you know, it, not the, the activities that most people are doing right now. And I do have some money that is going to expire, and I need to figure out a way to use it. And we always have Public Works in our back pocket who has projects always that they can expend the funding on. So we're probably just going to do a staff level allocation to them for wheelchair ramps or some sidewalk improvements in some low income neighborhoods. And then with regard to housing trust funds, we still have $59,986 in our housing trust fund pot. Although, I mean, obviously it's always being, you know, recharged with that marijuana money, but we don't allocate it again until, you know, whatever, 2022. So it's just going to sit there, and unless we have to draw on it because we have to address some emergency need. So if that happens, I'll let you know. And then just a little bit about which you'd heard already with the Housing Trust Fund money early on, that we helped pay for the Greenway meals and some of the non-congregate sheltering. And so that was, you know, what happened to some of that money. But that's pretty much it. I mean, that's what we've been doing primarily with the funding that we have and the social service grants. You know, we just awarded the money. That's how we do it. You know, once they're awarded, they get 2 allocations. And I did have a couple conversations where the grantees had to switch gears and do things a little differently. And, And we were very flexible and said, you know, obviously everybody has to do things differently. So, you know, just report on what you did and that'll be good. So I do have the reports. They're coming in now and I am compiling them. So come next January, if not before, we can get those numbers together and you guys can see what's been going on with that money before.
So Linda, just in terms of our agenda, have you covered 3 and 4?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So let me, are there any other questions about that? Jackie.
It's not a question, it's just a comment. I just want to thank Linda for her encyclopedic knowledge of how you can adjust and move all this grant money around legally to make it work for all our grantors. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Sometimes I think of it like that, I guess, now debunked Acorn video where... you know, if you know the rules, you kind of know how to get around them too, without really breaking them. But I feel like I should never say that.
recorded. Linda, I used to, in my organizational sociology class that I used to teach when I was working at SOU, there's really some great literature in about nonprofits and about how nonprofit managers do exactly what you're doing. Which is being using the system within the rules, but using it flexibly so that the substantive goals of the organization are met. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to be flexible in order to achieve the actual objectives. And in other words, not let the means drag down the ends. Mm-hmm. So finding that balance is difficult for all administrators, and you do a great job.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you very much. So that's all I had. Rich, did you want to talk about
I think we're ready to, I asked that we could get an update on CAHOOTS. And I know everybody is pretty, I'm assuming everyone is clear about the concept of a mobile crisis support team. And CAHOOTS is the Eugene name that is spreading around the country. So I wanted to just kind of share what I know from NAMI and the Real Solutions Coalition, which have been two of the groups that have been looking at how we can move a CAHOOTS-like program forward in the Valley. And so there's been a couple of fronts that I want to comment on. The first one is the city of Medford. And if you, does everybody remember that we had last year a really great report on their homeless action plan? Within that discussion, they held a study session that included CAHOOTS within that plan. And some of the city councilors there are advocates for the support from within the city around that. And so they've, if you've seen the papers, they've sort of made some steps forward. And in those steps, they include the possibility of funding for a consultant from CAHOOTS, Tim Black, to come and work with the community about how we would move forward. The second part of that is that they want to work collaboratively. It should be a county-wide or a several city-wide program. And so with that kind of caveat, they've taken some steps. Here in Ashland, well, let me just say, the coalition a month ago held a criminal justice CAHOOTS candidate forum. And there were all the mayoral candidates from Ashland and Medford, the county commission candidates, both Democrat and Republican, and the legislative candidates in terms of Pam Marsh. And they asked them, their support. And really, there was broad-based support from those folks about how we should move forward. So we know there's the electeds are moving in that direction. They've also, we had a forum with our police chief around CAHOOTS, sponsored by the Interfaith Social Justice Coalition. And the buy-in from police chiefs are really important. And both the Medford and Ashland City Police Chiefs have said, yes, sort of. And the sort of has to do with the exact model of what we would propose, which we haven't even got that far because you want Tim Black to come down and do it. So the city police chiefs are basically for it, cautious about what it would look like. You know, they want to, is it going to be just in Ashland? No, it should be everywhere. How that comes together and who's involved in it is the key piece. Incidentally, there's a cohort of four nursing students from OHSU who's adopted as their project, CAHOOTS. They showed up at the Medford City Council, did a tremendous job testifying for it, and they're working correction and help for it. So that sort of leaves us at Ashland in a way, in that the next step that is need to be coming out is support from our council and the Medford Council about how we can, we don't need to propose exactly what it looks like. We need to bring in the expertise from Tim Black and CAHOOT to help a broad base of people to move forward. So that's part of the report that I could get. And I just want to see if there's questions. Becky, unmute.
Do we know if the current city council has had a study session with a presentation from CAHOOTS? I'm looking at Linda, might know, or Gina, because that it would be so great, I think, if we could educate the new council and mayor when they come together and have them come in and do a presentation to really educate them on what the program is, because it's incredible.
Well, so I can add a little bit to that, and not to preempt your question, Echo. But I know, I mean, and you probably do too, Jackie, that our current mayor is familiar with CAHOOTS.
And I was with John on the tour. So yeah. we got to see all levels of the program in Eugene, and it was incredible. And we got to have personal conversations for about 2 hours with the CAHOOTS, the main, providers. It's an amazing program.
So I know that Mayor Strawberg is very in favor of the CAHOOTS model and the CAHOOTS program. And I did attend the Medford City Council study session presentation on CAHOOTS, or essentially the homeless plan and the piece about CAHOOTS that Kelly Matting did a really good presentation on, did a lot of research about. And essentially what came out of that is that Medford, Central Point, Ashland, I think, who else was there? Another police chief was there. They're very interested in having that here, and that we have a lot of the components already. So Jackson County Mental Health already has a crisis team in place, but they do not have mobility and they don't have staffing for 24 hours. And they had a presentation from Jackson County Mental Health where they talked about what they thought they would need in order to ramp up to have enough capacity to address a CAHOOTS style program. And then there was a mention of Mercy Flights has some vehicles that they might be willing to allow Jackson County to lease or use for that purpose. And then I don't know his name, but the executive director of the ARC, Gina probably knows, he also gave a presentation and sort of talked about how, you know, the dual diagnosis piece ties in. But the piece that they are missing is that CAHOOTS is tied to a facility, and that facility is just a crisis management facility, essentially. And the mental health director described it as a less than 24-hour hold. So they cannot stay longer than 24 hours, but it's just a place to take people if they are having, you know, a temporary crisis, and they can be there for a few hours and then they'll transition them out. So we don't have that here right now. So that was the other piece they mentioned.
Right. I would yes, add that as the planning goes forward, the proposal would be for both a CAHOOTS mobile unit, but also expanding and developing the crisis center, that 24/7 crisis center that kind of really doesn't exist now in our area, but needs to as part of it.
And they are thinking it could be the Medford Navigation Center. Jackie?
Just one thing I wanted to mention too that I thought was so incredible. The CAHOOTS staff all had, or at least the lead in the van, because there would be between 3 and 4 people in the van, they had walkie-talkies that were directly connected to the police, mm-hmm. so that they could have these conversations where they would say, okay, it's a domestic dispute, you know, CAHOOTS, we're going in first, we'll let you know if it gets out of hand or if we can't handle it. And so they, in probably, you know, it was like 90% of the cases, CAHOOTS was able to calm down those domestic disputes. And then the police, you know, were able to go off and do what they do instead of this other piece. And when you look at that whole concept of, you know, they use the expression restructuring the police and all of that. But that's an example of where you're reutilizing the way people help each other and how the two organizations would help each other. So it saved the police a ton of contact that they didn't have to make in a more negative way.
And I would say in a broad sense, it's also decriminalizing mental health.
Yes.
Because many of us that know this intimately, that the way that you people go through the mental health system is through the jail. So they start off with a criminal record before they get going. We have a mental health court, but it really doesn't help in terms of that decriminalization part. So it's a ongoing movement that's happening throughout the country. I would add that I believe in the racial justice resolution that the council approved, there's a part about supporting CAHOOTS. Is that not right?
Yes. Well,
CAHOOTS like model. Well, yes. Everybody's on a CAHOOTS like model.
Yeah.
And we can call it, really should call it a mobile crisis team. But so we are.
Rich, I wanted to say something relevant to what you just said. Ballot measure 110.
Right.
We'll see what happens with that. But that's obviously a part of exactly this conversation.
It is.
If that passes, the budget consequences will be interesting because it involves diverting some of the marijuana money, anticipates reduced law enforcement costs because people aren't going to jail. We'll see how the devils and the details actually work out if that passes. So that's, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that going forward. That was all I wanted to say.
In both cases, ramping up treatment instead of incarceration.
Exactly. And a harm reduction model instead.
Way of looking at it. I don't have any action steps in regard to that, other than I think it ought to be something on our radar, because as it's not going to happen overnight, but it is moving pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And so I think we ought to just keep it in scope, because it will reflect. I mean, one of the things we're going to talk about at the end of the meeting is how do we do planning at the end of the year? So this might be something that comes in to that level of planning that we do. So the next part of this, and I guess we can move through this pretty well, is setting our November and December meeting schedule. So I just remember in the past, we had to adjust them because of the holidays. Are we in that same place, Linda? Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a few options in there, one of which is to skip the meeting in November and just have a longer meeting in December, which we call our retreat, or having meetings at both. So I'm just going to put it out to you. We do have to do our CAPR, but I asked for an extension and we received it. So it's not that time sensitive. So as long as we do it at the December meeting, which is usually more casual because it's a retreat, but there will be that little bit, and it does have to be a public hearing. So if you do decide to skip the November meeting, then we'll do the CAPR in December along with whatever else you decide. But if you want to do it a November meeting, then we'll have to do the CAPR then. What do you guys feel like?
Well, am I muted? One of the things I'd asked Rich a little bit about was I'd love to learn more about resident-owned communities, ROC, which has to do with the whole concept of manufactured housing that is a quality build and people have ownership, a buy-in on the land as well as the unit. And it truly stays affordable from what I can see. And I think Neighborhood Umpqua is no. Oh, okay, I can see Rich shaking no. So
no, I'm very frustrated by my beeping that goes on. Oh. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
Okay, but anyway, so I just any opportunity that we have as a Housing and Human Services Commission to have a presentation, I think is so helpful. And our communities right now are going to be doing this huge rebuild. And we have, you know, we have the one mobile home park, it's in the county, but over there by Valley Inn, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of how much say we'll be able to have and how that is rebuilt. But I just want to mention that as I would love to see us have a presentation on that to get smarter about it.
Echo.
So I took a lot of notes at the study session on Monday. Linda, you were awesome.
Oh, thanks.
and so I started Googling around after that about the Daniel Paralek book that kept coming up and noticed that a lot of other communities are using that kind of as a Bible for this kind of discussion. So it's called Missing Middle Housing. And I've got it on my need to read list. And in Googling around on the Paralek book, I came across another book that seems to kind of be in the same vein by Diana Lind, L-I-N-D, called Brave New Home. And those two together kind of lay out a lot of the same issues that were discussed at that study session around how to incentivize developers to start constructing the kind of housing that the community needs, rather than just being focused on the kind of housing that produces maximum profit for investment companies. And there were things about accessibility and needing to make sure that new developments have, if people are going to be working from home, that means we need to have home office spaces in people's houses and homeschooling spaces in people's houses. I think it's going to be important for whatever, you know, I'm just, might be fantasy land on my part, but making sure that whatever gets developed has access to AFN, that in the ground infrastructure is there. Which would help to support our community-owned internet service, which I think we're very lucky to have. So I made tons of notes at that meeting, and I'll stop talking about them now, except it was really interesting, and I really appreciated all your work.
So I just want to respond to that. So Echo, if you would be interested in bringing together a book study around those books, I would be very interested in doing it collaboratively. Yeah. I would be interested in reading it collaboratively, because sometimes I get lost when I start reading educational material. It's not, it's not a novel. It doesn't hold me in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But if I did it in a study group, I would very much like to read what it says.
Yeah. Zoom book clubs definitely are a thing these days. So happy to do that.
So I'd like to just add about the mobile park situation. My son was at a Bear Creek mobile park and he got burnt to ashes, but he had a really decent insurance. So he's come out all right. The owner there has indicated that he wants to keep it as a mobile park. I talked with a city commissioner in Phoenix who was concerned about where we're going, because that whole swath of 99 is one of the biggest sources of affordable housing that we have in Southern Oregon. It's the biggest source of mobile parks in Oregon. And to lose that is a tragedy. I mean, we're trying to build maybe 50 units of affordable housing a year, and we lost hundreds, if not thousands, we lost hundreds and hundreds of units in that process. Pam March is one of the key leaders in the state in terms of understanding what is possible with that. And we funded for land trust opportunities, Umpqua Neighbor Works, which I've talked to with them, and they have a mobile park owned as a land trust in Roseburg as a model. So they are very interested in that model. The city councilor in Phoenix had talked to three of the mobile parks in Phoenix that all at that point said, yes, they want to continue as mobile parks. So I think there is, now it's not like bringing in old units or anything. It's all about rebuilding with sustainable manufactured homes, but those in which people own their homes. They may not own the land, but they own their homes. And so I think it would be useful for us to have a presentation, like Echo and others have said, it's like, can we learn a little bit more about that model? And I think we could. At what meeting, I guess I'm suggesting every time we say we're not going to meet in November, and it's always hard, but I think we always do. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of a housing crisis, I don't think we should take the time off if we can learn about what are some of the options in front of us.
Well, I would be happy to see if Pam Marsh would like to do a presentation, and maybe the November meeting can just be about all of these topics. So I know both Bill and Brandon have seen Dan Parallak speak at planners conferences, and there are some conference footage of him speaking about, you know, the process they went through and sort of how they came up with the idea of middle housing. So I'll touch base with Bill and Brandon and see if maybe one of them could do a presentation, or if they could recommend something for us to watch. But then I'll also reach out to Pam Marsh and see if she'd be willing to talk about, the work that she's doing now, and then also talk with NeighborWorks Umpqua to see if they could do a presentation via Zoom about the process of making parks ownership parks. And I know I actually, and maybe I mentioned this before, I spoke to the person who does my job in the city of Paradise a while back, and had a really good conversation with her. And she brought up some interesting things that I guess we'll see what happens. But she said in Paradise, they have 36 manufactured home parks, which burned down. And it's been, they are at their 2-year anniversary, I think she said, and in November, like November 4th. And she said there one is open now, and there's another one that is in the process, but that it has taken, I mean, she said they could, they didn't issue one building permit until 6 months after the fire, because it just, it took that long to get through the cleanup process and all those parts. And then even when they did start to issue building permits, all these things came up that they had, they did not anticipate. One of which is that manufactured home parks own their own infrastructure. And so, and I heard this just the other day, that this is where we're at now. So people who own manufactured home parks, like if they're mom and pop, right? Like they just have insurance, whatever kind of insurance. But she said what happened to them is when they depressurized all the water lines because they had to shut them all off, that depressurization sucked in all the smoke and ash and heat, and it leached out a chemical called benzene from the pipes that were underground that contaminated everything. And so all of those manufactured home parks had to replace all the infrastructure that was under the pavement. And it was, you know, they didn't realize it, but because it was all on their property, none of it got done by the city. The city didn't pay for any of it. And they were responsible for paying for those costs because they were just mom and pop organization. You know, I mean, they weren't such a big company. They just didn't have the money to replace all that infrastructure. It was really expensive. And CDBG cannot pay for infrastructure on private property unless it's part of a rehab. So she and I had a long conversation about the limitations of using CDBG in an emergency situation and how difficult it has been for them. They have some other stumbling blocks that are not issues that we have, that has also caused the delays. Like all permitting for mobile home parks go through the county, not through the city. And so they, and that's like Sacramento County, so it was much farther for them. So that was one of the stumbling blocks. But she said the lack of funding to address those issues, these unanticipated costs, those were some of the things that really derailed those manufactured home parks getting back online quickly in their communities.
So Linda, but it would be the case that they could pay for infrastructure if it was a nonprofit land trusted program.
So yes, it would be a little bit of an undertaking. There would be a process by which we would have to income qualify all of the residents of the park and show that the majority of them were low income. Which, I mean, in many of the situations, that would be totally fine. And then it would have to be owned by them. So you could not replace the infrastructure for a business, essentially. Right. That would not qualify. Although, anyway, there's a lot of finagling that could happen. And it's kind of a game of, well, what about this? Well, what if I did it this way? So, yeah, I mean, there are some possibilities there. But I'm just wondering, I think they're probably getting to that point where they're realizing what needs to be done. And at first, I think everyone thought, oh, you know, I mean, it's all paved, right? Like just clean it up and put new units on the pavement. But I don't think that's going to be as simple.
Well, can we just look at the dates? Because we usually can't do the fourth Thursday, but we do the third Thursday. Is that workable for...
So that is November 19th, Thursday, November 19th.
That works for me.
It looks like that's the date.
Okay, that was easy.
Yeah. And then the harder one, so I'm putting that in. The harder one is, in December, we kind of do long-term, we do yearly planning, but we still can't gather. Mm-hmm. Or can't, I mean, could we do a retreat that was, everybody was spaced out, or can we do one on Zoom?
Well, why don't we pick a date, and then maybe we can look at what options we have for how we could... we could do it. I mean, we always have the Zoom option, so that is always available. It's so sad because normally we buy food and like it's so fun, and I guess we can have a virtual potluck. That'll be
December 17th.
I would like to suggest that maybe we go 1 week earlier than that, because the holidays just get so busy towards the end. Could we do the 10th?
It's the beginning of Hanukkah, but I don't.
Yeah, it's a Thursday, December 10th. December. Does that work for people? Yeah.
I'm concerned that if we want to have speakers, especially if it's someone like Pam Marsh, we need to have some time to set that up. I'm not sure that having a meeting without a really good holidays. So, you know, I would say it's dependent on what we can come up with in terms of if we're doing a retreat. A Zoom retreat, I would want us to have a meaningful meeting.
Well, I'll touch base with Pam. Why don't we tentatively look at the 10th of December? Jackie, did you have an issue with the 10th? Okay. You're muted still. You're muted.
We're having two Aura donor events, and one is on the 8th and one is on the 10th, and they'll hit right at the time I think that you're talking about, unless you're doing something midday.
Well, and you know, I mean, it depends what would work for you guys. I can do it anytime in the day, and morning even or midday would be fine. Well, that'd be kind of fun. What if we did it with like coffee? I mean,
I can do that.
We would all be having our own coffee, obviously.
So let me just first say, I thought we could have Pam at the November meeting.
I did think that too. I was thinking Pam. Well, so here's what I can do. I'm going to stick with the Thursday, the 19th of November meeting date. I will ask Pam and NeighborWorks if the 10th in the morning or the 19th at the regular time, and then, you know, whatever time would work for them. I'll ask them about those times and dates, and then I will send out an email, and then maybe we can do a doodle poll for the December one. How do you guys feel about that?
Oh, I'm missing the question. If we had Pam and Umpqua, they would come at November, right?
Well, what I'll do is see if they're available, because if they're not available on November 19th, then we can we can schedule them for sometime in December and then sort of schedule around that. And then we do have other things to do at our November meeting, one of which would be to talk about what we want to do with the December meeting besides the speaker. And then I do have that tape room, which is kind of boring, but, you know, I have to do it.
I mean, at the other end of the year meetings, we did do a goal setting, or at least a goal adjustment. And that's what I like. So I hope that's one of the things that we have. Whether I like doing it in the morning, it's fine. But how you do it on a Zoom is a challenge. But to go into a new year without kind of revisiting our goals, I think we need to.
Well, so tentatively, we can do the goal setting. I mean, we can do the goal setting. And then, I mean, we traditionally have had a speaker as well. So we generally have a speaker and then do the goal setting piece. So if we end up having either Pam or NeighborWorks or both in November, maybe we can brainstorm about another speaker to have in December. Oh, or maybe that will be the Plant Middle Housing one.
I mean, Pam can speak easily for an hour and address mental health and how that's all working right now. And she manufactured housing. She's just burning with passion for that right now. So, you know, it'd be great on either day to get her for sure. It sounds like maybe the ROC and something from Bill or Brandon or, you know, that maybe is more like a November meeting. Whereas if we can get Pam, she would blow our minds, I think, for an hour and more.
So you would rather have Pam in December and then maybe have Brandon and NeighborWorks Umpqua in November. Yeah, November.
I think that would fit better. If we're thinking retreat and goal setting and inspiration, Pam can really inspire.
So how does that sound to everyone?
Hey, let me open the floor for everyone on the council to weigh in on this party. Chris, you got any? Gina?
I think we should ask them, and whatever one works fits their schedule, that's what we do.
I'm good with that.
Yeah, I agree with Gina as well. I realize Pam might be extremely busy, so getting her might be an issue.
I've been being a keyboard warrior and using good old Facebook, the new layout for which I detest. But there's an SOU alum named Misty Munoz who has become quite a leader and community activist, organizing mobile home manufactured housing residents in both Talent and Phoenix, communicating a lot with Pam, actually, because a lot of those residents are getting screwed around, frankly, being told really different, sometimes misleading things by the corporate owners of the ground and by their insurance companies. And Pam has been absolutely critical in getting accurate information about what residents do and do not have to do legally. And so Misty and Pam have kind of been amazing. So having those kind of community voices, resident voices, as part of whatever we talk about, you know, not just officials and people from nonprofits, but inviting, you know, just regular folks who have been directly affected because their houses burned down, making sure that they're part of maybe a retreat, a goal setting discussion. I think that'd be really important for us too.
Agreed.
Would you have enough to have us? We've got a potential December 10th earlier session and a November 17th, whatever it was. Do you have enough to get us started on this?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
And Gina's issue with the Hardesty property, RV parking, you know, places for more informally housed people. I don't want us to forget that. By the third week in November, you know, the winter shelter, I think, will be up and running. Is that
November
true?
November 1st. Yeah, November 1st, it'll be running.
Yeah, so we're definitely going to want to know how that's going and how demand for winter shelter has been affected by the displaced persons in Talent and Phoenix, because I'm expecting that. And Chris, you're kind of the unofficial SOU liaison, I think, at this point. Sorry, I gave you a job. There was sort of a discussion between Ashland Parks and Rec and SOU about making some SOU unused dorm rooms available to non-SOU affiliated people. I don't think that ever happened, did it?
I'm not aware, or at least I haven't received any information on that. The only information I'm aware of is the usage of Cox Hall, and that was mostly for students and their families,
right,
or displaced colleagues. So that's the only information I have, right, about that part of it.
So there was confusion because there was a news item, press release that made it sound like SOU had changed its mind and was going to open up some unused dorm space for non-SOU affiliated people. And then it didn't actually happen as far as I can tell. And I watched an APRC meeting on RVTV. And I did see Michael Black at one of those meetings, maybe two or three meetings ago, say that he had been part of a conversation with SOU around that. And then I haven't heard anything else. I frankly would be surprised if SOU opened up any of those unused spaces for just community housing. I really think that's unlikely.
Right.
But I know there will continue to be pressure on the university to do that as part of a solution to, you know, this immediate housing need. So that's something else we might try to follow up on. Here's my cat. See my cat. Hey, hi, Vera. This is Vera. She's 21.
My gosh. Wow.
Chris, also, you had a report that you handed in for us, and I got it so quickly before I just have only possibly skimmed it. Did you want to highlight anything within that?
I do. There was lots of information to update from our last meeting. So this is fairly new information for me as well. So just bear with me as this is kind of new. So as of now, 99 students have been tracked as far as reporting our reporting system as being impacted on some capacity with the fire. And we're talking about just the fire here. And of course, that's including probably some of their families as well. So it's not just 99 students; it could potentially be some of their families. We're continuing to use our reporting system as we hear about it or we learn about it from our students. But that's the update on the fire part. We have a couple of students who are also firefighters, but we're really unsure about the reports on if they returned or what's going on. So we even got some firefighters as students that are kind of missing at this point. So we don't even know anything about them. As far as the COVID situation, we're still doing lots of assessments here. Just recently, Monday and Tuesday, we basically tested all of our athletic folks. And so we should be able to hear something soon. We're just now getting a lot of COVID tests. And we're actually just taking on a case-by-case basis. If they have symptoms, then of course we're giving them the test, put them in quarantine and following the usual protocol. I think that's kind of generalizing most of the information that I sent everyone kind of last minute. So just know that we're still trying to find creative ways of educating our students because we still have a few reports that some students are not kind of following the mask and the social distancing. So we're trying to find new ways of educating, but also kind of enforcing that a little bit more. So, yes, Linda.
So I have a dumb question. Is SOU open and are students on campus?
So we have a few buildings that are open, but they're only open for students. And of course, as they come in, like for example, in the building that I am in, they have to actually go through only one entrance. They have to present their ID. And then of course, they need to have the mask on at all times and follow the social distancing. So it's really, really restricted. But as far as students actually being here, it's almost non-existent. So a lot of our students are taking their classes online, and they will be continuing to take their classes mostly online as well in the winter. So
I had a question.
Yeah, Jackie.
Just as one part, when you're talking about known specific students who violate policies, go to Tory. And I wasn't sure if that was a person or a place or what that is.
It's actually a person. So we're also on the enforcement part because there are some students who are not wearing their mask or not properly socially distancing. We are, again, trying to find the protocol on who to send, who's going to enforce that, and then also educate. And I mean, the rule is basically, from what I'm gathering, is If they don't comply after the second time, they're not allowed on the property at all. So we are taking it seriously.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I also noticed that there's some mental health supports for fire-affected students. Mm-hmm. There's a fire. I just saw this in an email, an SOU email. There's a fire support group that meets Tuesdays, 3:30 to 4:30 through Zoom, through the office of the Dean of Students. This group will be a space for sharing experiences and receiving support for all students impacted by the recent fires in Southern Oregon and the West Coast. Drop-ins are welcome, et cetera, et cetera. It's Emily Holgren is running those.
Yep, and not just it stops there. It actually continues with other mental illnesses. I mean, our staff are really working overtime on that counseling part because, you know, we're all affected, of course, by the fire or the economy or there's always something. So I've actually referred several of my students to the Dean of Students as well. So, yes, we're trying.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It's really good to get this report. It feels like we're more connected. And I think that's really a positive step. The next thing that we were looking on our agenda was the council social equity resolution. And I thought it might, was it included in the packet?
Yes.
Yes. It should have been.
It was. Okay.
So okay. I didn't look at it. So I'm going to, it looks like Jackie's got it out. Maybe somebody could give us just a quick overview. Is there a quick overview? I know there's a piece about the cahoots in there.
Let's see if I can find
it. You're muted. You're muted, Jackie.
Oh, sorry, my dog was sort of doing chirpy things. I couldn't find specifically cahoots, but in section two, it gives the actions that they're going to take. I can just read those if you want.
That would be great because mine didn't print out right.
Okay, so it says moving forward, the city of Ashland will. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Support the Ashland Police Department in taking a more active role in on-campus conversations about racial justice at SOU and in developing engagement events to help local residents understand APD's policies regarding use of force and other relevant issues. And then B, strengthen our cultural competency and intrinsic bias training program for members of the city council and city staff. C, display Black Lives Matter signs at city-owned locations to offer visible and immediate support for racial justice advocates in our community. D, continue and enhance our support of the annual celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. E, connect with SOU and its students to better understand the experience of all college students, particularly students of color, in the city of Ashland is a first step toward improving that experience. Through this process, the city will help all local college students understand the city's ideals and expectations regarding respect for all people. F, work with community partners to develop training, incident response, and community acknowledgement programs that help residents and business owners address the long-term systemic root causes of inequality and racial injustice and celebrate progress. G, work with Jackson County and neighboring communities to develop a program that will provide trained mental health professionals for instances where the Ashland Police Department is called upon to serve the needs of people who are suffering from mental health issues and or addiction. That's the one I think that kind of fits cahoots, doesn't it? Kind of, I know.
That's the one that I marked. That's a good one.
Yeah. Okay, there's just four more. H, determine the feasibility of a mural project to provide a mode of artistic expression of our community's commitment to making meaningful, visible, and ongoing progress on issues of social equity and racial justice. I, request a proactive review of the policies that pertain to the standard process of investigating incidents where deadly force is used in Jackson County. J, review recruiting hiring practices to address implicit bias with input from leaders of local diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And the last one is K,
renew the effort with Indigenous leaders in the community to find a solution to the renaming of Dead Indian Memorial Road. I think it's a start, you know, it's to, I think the way we're looking at it is, I know there was a lot of controversy over this. Yeah, go ahead, Gina.
So, you know, I read this before and I read it a few minutes ago, and I understand that it's a start, like you said. However, it was written by people who are not in the BIPOC community. And I feel very strongly that this needs to be written by the people that it affects. And because it wasn't, there definitely needs to be some buy-in. I just, you know, support of MLK. Well, you know, I think that, and then Juneteenth, I read in Juneteenth. Yeah, one thing that I thought was good was H. I liked H. But now this thing is here. I'm not going to go over all of what has happened, that I'm sorry it happened this way personally. But now that it's here, I believe, I know we have tons of commissions, but in a nutshell, you guys, I would like to see a group of people from the BIPOC community. And also, let's pull in the police chief and have people at the table that are on a commission to be able to implement all of these things that they say are action items. Because to me, some of these things are not action items. And who is going to do the training and hold people accountable? And, you know, so I just, it's here. And because it's here, we need to do it right. That's what I'm saying. And to me, writing down a bunch of words, then we say this is action, Black Lives Matter sign. You know, one thing that I really did like is that having art, cultural art throughout the town, I thought that would so much, so be cool. And that would just really enhance it. Yes, we do accept everybody and we are a loving community by seeing art. So to me, I would really like to have a commission, a group of people who make sure this is implemented right, and maybe go over this and make this a living document so that it has the ability to grow and change as we grow and change as a community, and not say this is it, and that's all. And, you know, it has to have some color in it, you know.
Quite literally.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Rich, oh. You're muted.
Hear you, Rich. Rich can hear you.
Well, I'd like to comment a little bit because I think it does give us a challenge about our commission. And I would like to see us use a racial justice lens in how we do our future planning. And taking Gina's suggestion, that would mean really bringing in someone to help us develop that lens to look at housing. I've mentioned before, and maybe you've read the book Color of Law, but it is a tremendous history, tremendous evaluation of our racist history in housing in our country. And it laid out so well, it's become a classic in just a year. And so a lot of the segregation and racial discrimination in housing and zoning particularly is invisible. And it has really divided our community. So I think there's some steps that we could take as a commission that would begin to address that racial justice lens as we go forward. Book?
Rich, what was the name of that book?
It's called The Color of Law, and it's by Rosenstein. Rich. Rob Rosenstein, I think, something like that. It's a classic. Everybody.
Oh, here we go. I found it.
You got Rich. It?
I think yeah. I found it.
Gina.
something that I would like to touch on. I love how you said to bring someone in, because when we think about housing and it's going to impact certain individuals, I like what Echo brought up earlier about Misty Munoz. Let's bring in somebody who this is going to affect. This is where I live. This is where I want to continue to live. And this is how it's going to impact me and my community. So I think it would be great to speak to some people, persons right here. And this is going to affect where my kids go to school and where I work and where I live. I think listening to our constituents would be great.
Linda.
So some of you might remember that there is some of this language in the analysis of impediments to fair housing choice. And we do have funding to address fair housing training. So that's kind of rich, I think, when you mentioned sort of in advancing racial justice in housing issues, that is traditionally the avenue that we have taken. And over the years, the Fair Housing Council has, you know, each year we try to do something different. I mean, most of the times it's sort of basic fair housing training for different providers. But then there are some larger forums. And probably 3 years ago, there was a really great forum where they had a speaker. It was in Medford at the Higher Education Center. I cannot remember her name, but she was actually, I think, from the East Coast. And I think I wrote it in the analysis of impediments. Her phrase that she used over and over was risen in the dough, that racism is risen in the dough of housing policy. And like, because of that, it's like baked in. Anyway, I loved that analogy. But the other pieces of that, so she was the keynote speaker, but the other speakers, one was Chelsea Rose, who talked about the Chinese in Jacksonville and the discrimination they faced. One was Ama Rosa, and she talked about her own, you know, I mean, the history of the Bracero program and the discrimination and terrible living conditions that they faced and how, you know, it was starkly different from the German prisoners of war, how they were treated. And that Japanese, there was a Japanese piece too in there somewhere. Anyway, but she talked about her own experiences of being discriminated against in housing transactions when she came here. And then Jeff LaLand talked about the KKK. So I know we have a lot of things on our list, but that is definitely something that is within our purview and things that we've done in the past. And now the Fair Housing Council has an employee here who is Meg, I can't remember her last name, but she came from Rogue Valley Council of Governments. And she is now their new Fair Housing Coordinator down here. And I did talk to her a while back about training opportunities. So that could be something that maybe in December, if you guys think about what we want to plan for the coming year and how we can do that, that could be one way to advance racial equity in housing, or at least to provide that education. Echo?
And before I back in July, before I got distracted by other things in life, Rich and I had a really long phone conversation about some broader issues like this, including looking at some models for what are called racial equity and social justice impact assessments. There are some models out there. I'm just looking at Google on the other side of the screen. There are some models of actual templates, checklists, to evaluate what the impacts would be of any kind of city policy, but particularly housing policy, for BIPOC communities, low-income folks, people in disabled communities. And really kind of, I would like to see something like this in the resolution, in the ordinance that City Council did, that would actually require the city and its and this now this city manager to complete this kind of assessment for policy changes. And so I reminded that I was going to follow up on this, and then I didn't, because Rich and I had a really good conversation one day about this stuff. So Rich, I want you to know it's back on my brain.
Can you send me information about that?
Yeah.
And, maybe we can start and we can have a conversation maybe at our November meeting and look over what's in there and see if maybe we could have a process where we talk with planners and see if we can maybe get that adopted as part of a plan review. I mean, that's really broad of me to say. I have no idea. But
and then we have to hope we have change in leadership at HUD around the fair housing regulations, but we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, we'll see.
Well, this has been a very fertile discussion. The next thing we had was general announcements and updates. Linda, do you have some?
You know, the only updates I have, I have to apologize. I missed the continuum of care meeting this week, and I heard it was really good, and but I might have missed important things. So I'm going to have to touch base with Connie about that. I did attend the homeless task force meeting, and Connie gave an update about a process that the state, I think, is working on, because I also missed the state homeless meeting last week. And it's called MAST, M-A-S-T-T, and it really is about identifying all of your shelter capacity, specifically for winter and for displaced people. And so they're trying to create a comprehensive list. I know part of it is that, you know, there are a lot of homeless people who were displaced by the fire, but they are not considered, they are not treated or viewed in the same way by the agencies providing resources because they were not housed prior to the fire. And so there is some concern about how are we addressing their needs. And there has been a little bit of traction on if they can be proven as having resided in the fire location by an official, then they can be eligible for some funding or resources. And the bigger part of the conversation and where it's, I think, just turns into, you know, just, well, we're trying to get a handle on it, is there's going to be a group who's going to start meeting to talk about shelter resources. And it's not, I mean, it is the seasonal shelter aspect, but also the emergency cold weather shelter aspect, which we are working on. There are some ideas, but we don't have anything set in stone at this time. So what I have been tasked with is looking at options, bringing those options forward, and then hopefully making a decision about how we can address this concern. And the piece, how these two things are aligning, is that what we don't know is how many people are going to be needing cold weather shelter. I mean, we know that both ORA and Maslow have a certain capacity to provide for some unhoused people, but we're just not sure what that population is going to look like now that we have these people who were living on the Greenway and who were displaced. And with COVID, how is that going to impact our space needs? How will we address you know, that sheltering piece with the safeties in place? I mean, if it was an average of 25 people, maybe we could do it in certain locations. But if it's really like 40 or 50 people, I don't know that we could address that. And we do have some other resources with the campground in Medford. They're up to 45. They started at 25. They're up to 45. I think I heard that they have moved 153 people through and only have had to eject 2 people. So, I mean, they're moving those people from, you know, the Greenway to their camp and then on to other housing, more, you know, stable to permanent housing options. So they are looking again at expanding for the winter. And so that could be a resource, but the expo is closing. And so there have been a lot of people sheltering at the expo. So where will they go? So that is all being discussed. We're working on coming up with a plan, and we're trying to coordinate throughout the county and create a comprehensive list so that we can all share resources and just try to work really efficiently with what we have in the population we're seeing. That was a lot. Sorry.
How about we meet every week? all this stuff. No.
That'll be the book club.
Yeah, everything just changes so fast, and you could just get new direction. There's some new emergency shelter grant funding that can address different things, but who knows? We'll see. So I will keep you posted on that as we move forward.
Are there anybody have any other updates they want to add in?
I just want to mention that Aura has a press release that's coming out hopefully tomorrow, but very soon, about the winter shelter, up to 45 people. And we're very confident that it's all going to go well. There's just some I's being dotted and T's crossed, and the neighborhood that we're looking at checking out. But it's all in very good hands between Cass Sinclair and the staff. And of course, all the winter shelter is 5 months with vetted people who get to have a bed and stay in it for the whole time. And we, of course, Aura is hiring staff to cover everything. And then the navigators will be coming in twice a day, morning and evening, working with the shelter guests to try to get them housed. So that's sort of what's happening there. And there's more news coming, but it's just a lot going on behind the scenes. So stay tuned.
Can I ask Linda Rapond how she's doing?
I'm fine. How am I doing personally? How am I doing my hotel is doing?
In the hotel.
Mm-hmm. I'm housing some monthly people right now. Okay. Some fire victims and some Aura guests. And so I'm it's paying the bills. Okay. Not going to get rich, but paying the bills.
Okay. Good to know.
Thank you.
I want to, if we end, I want to float an idea that I talked with Linda about. And that is, I'm getting really old. And so I'm thinking, if someone is interested in cycling into chairing meetings, I think it could be a good thing. And so if anybody wants to think about that and talk with me or Linda, that would be a good next step down the way. So got a new year coming. So
the rich
and the other part up? What?
When is your term up?
April.
Oh, soon.
Right. Yep. So I want to be on the board. I'm not sure that I need to be the one that chairs the meeting, but
okay, that's, just don't go anywhere. If
that's just open out there. The other question is, Aaron has apparently recycling or a member. Did I see that right, Linda?
So Erin has been accepted into the nursing program. And so she has become very busy in the last year. And she is feeling that she just really is not going to be able to devote a lot of time or as much time as she feels this group deserves. So she's probably going to be resigning soon now. we'll be sad to lose her, but I will talk to the city recorder to see what the process is for advertising for a new member. And then certainly if any of you know of anyone who wants to join or is interested, definitely just send them my way and I'll talk to them.
I mean, I think we have a really strong group, and as we've seen, we've got really crucial things that we deal with every meeting. And so anyway, I hope we can continue that and bring on some new person and continue on. And any other thing, the announcements? Well, then I guess we can say good goodbye for now, and we'll see each other in November.
Live long and prosper.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, everyone. Good luck, Tina. Good luck.
Thank you. Enjoy the debate.
Yeah.
Enjoy the debate.
Bye, all. See you guys.